come up on tight wire.
I'm in Studio B, sitting right next to my good friend, Daniel Chacon.
And I'm sitting in the exact same studio across from my good friend, Benjamin Alida Sainz.
And welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
Today we have a new fiction writer named Patrick Michael Finn, whose latest book just won the 2011 Hudson Prize. And the name of that book is From the Darkness Right Under Our Feet. It is a great example of literary fiction. These characters are very deep and oftentimes disturbed. So we're going to enjoy talking to him. He's a great guy.
And our poem of the week comes to us from Shin Yu Pai from her new book, Owl Arcs. And our poetic license comes to us from you, Daniel. You'll be talking about the difference between lit fic, as you say, and pop fic.
Pop fic, yes, yes.
So that's literary fiction and popular fiction. So it's going to be a great show. So stay tuned to another great edition of Words on a Wire.
Patrick Michael Finn was born in Joliet, Illinois, and was raised there and in rural Southern California. He completed his BA at the University of California, Riverside, and his MFA at the University of Arizona, where he was a Dean's Teaching Fellow. Finn is the author of the novella A Martyr for Susie Kosovich and the story collection From the Darkness Right Under Our Feet. His stories have appeared in Plowshares, Tri-Quarterly, Third Coast, Quarterly Rest, the Clackamas Literary Review, Punk Planet, and Houghton Mifflin's The Best American Mystery Stories 2004. His fiction has also received citations in the 2005 Pushcart Prize and the Best American Short Stories 2008. Patrick Michael Finn, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you for having me. I'm very, very honored to be here.
And congratulations on your wonderful book. It's called From the Darkness Right Under Our Feet, and that title really captures the spirit of the book. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I worked on it for almost 10 years. I started it in graduate school, and I knew that I wanted to write about the place where I grew up, where I spent the first 16 years of my life.
Joliet, Illinois.
That's right, which is an industrial city right outside of Chicago. I hesitate to call it a suburb because suburb usually indicates nice.
Right, right, yeah.
And it wasn't very nice. At the time I lived there, the population was 78,000, and they had an unemployment rate of 25%. Which is pretty high.
And they have a prison there, too, don't they? Isn't it well-known for its prison?
Yeah, it's really well-known for its prison. The nickname of the town is the City of Stone and Steel because of its steel industry and its mining, rock mining industries. And those were all shut down by the time I was a young man there. So it was deindustrialized and Rust Belt, much like a lot of the right. Industrial Midwest.
And your book, you said you were working on it for 10 years. That's a long time to work on a book. I guess you're like a lot of writers, like me. You write slow, but what I'm wondering is to be in those characters' heads and in that dark world for 10 years, how did that affect you and your relationships?
Well, for many years, I didn't have any relationships. You know, I was...
serves you right.
I do write slowly, and I consider that book in a lot of ways my apprenticeship because I was really learning how to write. And I was still, you know, figuring out who to read and what to read and figuring out these characters and, you know, letting them tell me who they were. And so it was a very long time. There were a lot of stories I wrote over that period that never wound up in the book. You know, I got to a point where I actually just stuffed it in a drawer and said, I don't think this thing will ever see the light of day. It's not getting picked up. Nobody seems to be interested in reading about poor working class people. And then for a few months I was, you know, pretty depressed that this thing I'd spent at that point, about 9 years on, just wasn't going anywhere. And I picked myself up and said, you know, you're the only person who is going to make this thing happen if you want it to happen, if you want it to see the light of day. And so I spent a year completely rehauling it, taking out weaker stories, writing new, better stories. And then not long after, I got the call from Diane Gettle at Black Lawrence, said I'd won the Hudson Prize. So, it was a long, long effort.
What year did you win the Hudson Prize?
I won it in 2009.
Oh, I was 2007.
Wow.
Hudson Prize.
It's kind of a game changer, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Because I had stories in the collection published in pretty prestigious places, and I had publications, but it is a game changer once you have the book.
All right.
It's like you're part of the, you can say you're part of the team finally, I guess.
Is writing painful for you?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes it is. Sometimes just the process of trying to say something, trying to say something meaningful and interesting, it just isn't there. And I feel blocked up. It's not really writer's block, I don't think, but yeah. But that's painful when I can't access whatever it is that that makes writing fun for me. and I like to have fun when I'm doing it. Even if I know what I'm writing is going to get scrapped, that's fine. As long as I'm coming up with something that will inform a later chapter or will let me know about a character, will give me information about a character, the way the character thinks or the way the character looks, that's fun. But when I'm not having fun, then it's painful. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring up the word fun because, you know, I've been writing for 20-some-odd years, and I would never use that word, fun, for writing. And I think I'm most alive when I'm writing.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to think that I'm most myself and I'm most alive in every sense of the word. But fun wouldn't come to mind.
You know who challenged that notion? And I haven't always thought of it as fun. You know, I was taught that it was, you know, hard work, that you diligently approach the desk every day to make sure it happens in kind of a puritanical way.
Or if you're a Catholic way.
Or Catholic way, right. Right, with a great deal of discipline awaiting at the other side of the podium. And my best friend, who's a writer, Michael Jaime Becerra, and we've been friends for almost 20 years, and as a writer, he's anything but a hobbyist. I mean, he takes it very seriously, but he said, you know, when I approach the desk, I approach it as a hobby, you know, to make it fun, to make it enjoyable. And that really revolutionized the way I think about it.
Well, that is interesting. We're talking to Patrick Michael Finn, who is the author of the new book, From the Darkness Right Under Our Feet, a collection of stories that won the 2011 Hudson Prize. I've always told my students, I teach, you know, here at the MFA program at the University of Texas, and I always tell my students one of the differences between popular fiction and literary fiction is in literary fiction, the characters determine the story, and in popular fiction, the characters are dragged around by the plot in order to fit its needs. You are, after reading your work and knowing a little bit about you, certainly a literary fiction writer. Your characters are real. Your characters determine so much about the reality of their lives. And if they're messed up lives, it's the characters that are messing them up.
Right.
But being a literary writer is thankless. I mean, you know, we don't make tons of money. You know, it's we don't sell tons of books. Have you ever been tempted just to say, you know what, I'm going to use a gnome de plume and I'm going to write a best-selling vampire book? Because you have the talent.
Oh, man. Yeah, I've had dollar signs for eyes along the way. You know, actually, the novel I'm working on that I've been writing for the past couple of years, for a period, I thought it was going to be, I was going to try to write it as a commercial, you know, plot-driven crime story. And I, you know, dutifully wrote out the whole plot, and I was very happy with the way the plot had come out, and was gonna follow that. And I started to get hung up. I just couldn't. It just wasn't working. It felt inauthentic. And again, Michael Hyman Becerra, I was talking to him about it, and he said, "Well, how can you know what your character is going to do on page 300 if you don't even know who your character is yet?" And, you know, I paused and I said, "Well, you're right. How on earth would I know what he would do if I don't even know really who that character is?" But then I just scrapped the outline, and my wife, who's always my first reader, she's a poet, Valerie Bandura. And she said, you didn't get into this for the money. You didn't get into this for the notoriety. When I met you, you were in it for the art." And so she kind of regrounded me.
Spoken like a poet, for sure.
Exactly.
And, you know, also, Patrick, I think that even if we do say, yeah, we're going to do that, and then we sit down and we start seeing our characters, you know, dragging around like cardboard, pieces of cardboard, it fights against us. We just can't do it, and we have to go back. I once heard that Donald Barthelme tried to write a conventional story, and that was his version of it.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I have my novels are really an exploration of characters, and yet I always know what's going to happen.
Oh, wow.
I always do. I have the whole story. Before I sit down to write, of course, I write in my head. When I sit down to write a story or even a novel, I've thought about it for months.
Mm-hmm.
For months. Mm-hmm. It's been in my head. And I know the name of the character, and I have the first line, and I have the last line. And I know what's going to happen. And, you know,
you've lived with them for a long enough time to be able to know what exactly is going to happen.
I guess so, because I just, like, I sit down. I sometimes write a story, like the last story in my last collection of stories, the last story, I just lived with this story for so long, I wrote it in 5 days.
Wow.
And it's a long story. But I had lived with this story.
You write when your eyes are closed and you're laying down.
It's true.
And so you're still being surprised. You know, and also I think that there's a difference between what you do and I do too, and I know Toni Morrison does this, I know Borges does this, I know a lot of my icons or my heroes have done this. They have the very last image, right down to the very last, the language exact before they start a novel. But it doesn't mean on the way to that you're not going to be surprised.
Oh, of course.
Right.
I always write a scene that I hadn't planned on.
Yeah.
Several, actually, which is interesting.
Your fiction is very character-based. You know, you're a literary writer, too. You just happen to be one who makes money at it. One of the few.
Oh, something else I wanted to mention is that I don't know if Ben remembers this, but Ben, you're responsible for my first published story.
Oh, refresh
my memory, Patrick.
You selected my story, The Retard of Lard Hill, in 1999 for the AWP Intro Journal Award.
That's right.
And it was published, and it won, because you selected it, and it appeared in Quarterly West number 50.
That is amazing.
Nice.
That was my first story. That was my first published story in the short story collection.
And I remember that story, and it was like it really stuck out for me, you know.
That's because both of you guys have really depressing characters.
Well, I loved the story, actually. Do you know what I also remember is that I was a little bit challenged by, when I turned in my list, by the people in charge. They were a little surprised by my selections.
Oh, I love court and controversy.
I just kind of blankly like wrote a email back and said, "No, I'm sure about this," because they asked me if I was sure. I said, "I'm very sure."
Oh, thank you for standing up. Thanks for standing up to them. Otherwise, I would not have had that story published.
You know, and I think in all our careers, there's always been somebody who's went out on a limb to do that for us. You know, that somebody you know, who believes in it, who sees it beyond maybe their expectations. And with, especially with, you know, with your work, I think once you really get into your work and get into your landscape, it's an amazing world, which is kind of why I mentioned Conrad, because there really is a heart of darkness in your landscapes. You know, you enter into that, and
well, that's a wonderful compliment.
It's a hard place to get out of.
Patrick, have you ever read J.G. Ballard?
You know, a lot of people have recommended him to me, and I have not yet. I've not yet checked him out.
Well, there is really odd, but you should start with Empire of the Sun.
Okay.
You know, Spielberg misrepresented his work in his movie, but I would start there. And then he has the collected works, and it's a tome, collected stories. Mm-hmm. I actually spent one summer reading them all. They're amazing and weird, but he's been quite a mentor for me.
That's fantastic. I've written both of those down. Right now.
Well, Patrick Michael Finn, congratulations on winning the Hudson Prize. Your book is it certainly deserves it, and I hope a lot of people go out and buy it.
Thank you so much for your time.
And thank you for appearing on Words on a Wire.
Yes, Patrick, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Shin Yu Pai is the author of several poetry books, including, most recently, Adamantine. Her work has been commissioned twice by the Dallas Museum of Art, and she is a former writer-in-residence for the Seattle Art Museum. Her poem is entitled, Meow Meow Kitty Kitty Death Rattle. We don't know why you died that morning. Court saw you steal into the yard. Meow meow kitty cat. Death rattle buzz of flies gathered around your corpse when we came home that day, gaseous spasms jerking a life force. I stood over your remains, watching, nerves refire, remembering how sound is the last sense to leave the body before passing. That was a poem. Meow Meow Kitty Kitty Death Rattle by Shin Yu Pai. This week's poetic license comes to us from my good friend Daniel Chacon. He's going to reflect on the difference between literary fiction and popular fiction. Daniel?
Yes, I can say that I am a successful writer, but in the genre of literary fiction. Let me clarify the difference between literary fiction and regular fiction, or pop fiction. Here's an example of pop fic. The character comes home one day to find his wife and kids tied up with guns pointed to their heads. The bad guy knows that he's the best computer mind in the city, and they want him to do a job for them, to destroy the White House. There are car chases, shootouts, full frontal descriptive nudity, and in the final chapter, the hero violently disposes of the bad guys and everyone lives happily ever after. That's pop fiction. Oh, and often it has vampires, witches, and sells about 1 million copies. In literary fiction, the hero sits and thinks. You find passages like this. And then it occurred to him he liked the taste of water, that silky iron freshness pouring down his parched throat. And he remembered when he was a child, and his father, drunk again, threw him in the water, and he hit his head on a rock, and they had to take him to the hospital. Worthless kid, his father said, driving him there with a can of beer between his legs. Shelley Berman says of his favorite literary writer, frankly, I don't know why that man has to seek success. He can have so much fun just thinking. Literary writers tend to reflect a lot, sometimes too much for their own good. My mom used to say to me, Danny, you think too much. Stop it. Not much has to happen in literary fiction, but there's a lot of thought. Oh, and the book sells about 7 copies. Here's another difference between pop fic and lit fic. In popular fiction, there is metaphor. In literary fiction, there is infinite metaphorical possibility. In the pop fic example, the bad guys are a metaphor for terrorists trying to destroy the American way of life. The White House is a metaphor for the White House. In the lit fic example, about the hero sitting on a chair thinking of the taste of water, the water could be a metaphor for spirit, water is spirit, and what he thirsts for is some spiritual fullness that he needs. Or no. Water is metaphor for life itself. You can't live without water. We are 98% water, etc. Water is a metaphor for how we should get off his chair and do something. In LitFic, the water, the chair, all of it can represent so many things, which is why students of literature can read a 5-page story by Kafka and write a 15-page paper about it. There is not a single metaphor. There are metaphorical possibilities, and for 100 years, literary scholars can argue about what you meant when you wrote, "He liked the taste of water." Another difference in pop fiction, there's a lot of fast-moving detail, and it's like a movie playing in your head. Has that ever happened to you? You're reading a book, and you forget you're reading, and you're seeing it all like a movie in your head? Most likely that was pop fiction. In literary fiction, that can happen too, but often the detail is more like a series of paintings or photographs, more than a fast-running movie. In LitFic, there can be excruciatingly slow detail. A writer can go on for 7 pages describing a tree. Sometimes the passages are so descriptive that you find yourself pausing and just to count how many pages are left in the chapter. Sometimes you just want to cut to the chase, right? The literal meaning of cut to the chase is to cut through all the literary bullcaca and get to the car chase. Another difference is that people who read LitFic do it because they have to for a class. We have a small audience compared to the Harry Potter books. You don't find a vast selection of our books in Barnes & Noble, and you don't find people reading our books in the airport or on a bus. Have you noticed that Barnes & Noble have a section called Fiction and Literature? Literature is the occasional book by a dead person, like Hemingway or Hart Crane, or a literary writer like me, if we're lucky to be on the shelves, and fiction is everything else. We write serious literature. My books are taught in literature classes. Seriously. I visit universities where sometimes hundreds of students have read one of my books. And college and university students are brilliant, so they often convince me that I've written a masterpiece. If you have never visited a college where students and professors have read your book, I highly recommend it. A student at Vanderbilt University told me, "I like how your character kept using linguistic patterns with soft S's and hard K's. It expresses tonally the dual nature of his personality." And when this person was done telling me how great my book was, and she was a young woman, an English major, women tend to be better readers and more serious students, when she was done telling me about my complex use of assonance and alliteration, I'm all, "Yeah, I'm glad you caught that." I had no idea my character spoke that way. But if you have never been required to read me by a college professor, you have probably never heard of me, even though I'm, quote, a successful writer. Now let's define successful for a LitFic writer. I make, $200 to $300, sometimes $900 a year from my writing. This was a good year because I just had a book come out and I've made about $8,000 so far, most of it from readings at universities. It's one of my best years. It's a thankless business. But we like to believe that what we do is culturally important. We see ourselves as the keepers of the language, the guardians of metaphor, and we don't want to get real jobs. When I was a kid, I was a dreamer like most kids. Everyone's a genius until they're 7 years old. I was always lying in bed, looking up at the ceiling in my bedroom, imagining it was a forest or a white city on another planet. My dad called it being lazy. When I became a teenager, I laid on the same bed, looking up at the same ceiling and still imagining I could see other worlds. "Get out of bed, you worthless kid," my father yelled. "Go clean something." When I was in junior high school, he told me, "Boy, you're too lazy to have a real job. You better go to college." My father was a real man. He carried a lunchbox to work, wore a hard hat, got drunk on weekends, and abused us. He thought anyone who didn't wear work boots and put in an honest day of labor, 14 hours, didn't really work. He believed I would end up in prison because I was a bad teenager. I sold weed in junior high, and in high school, firecrackers and sticks of dynamite. Now I sell books out of the trunk of my car. So he thought I was going to end up in prison, but something happened that changed my life. I started to read. It went all to hell after that. My promising future in an orange jumpsuit, gone. I lay on my back all day reading Faulkner, Hemingway, Mark Twain. My dad would see me lying around and he'd yell, "Get your ass out of bed and do something. Fix something." When I barely graduated high school, I was faced with the choice, get a real job or go to school. I had nothing I really wanted to study, but I thought college would be a hell of a lot better than lifting stuff, which is what a real job was. After high school, my older brother, got a real job as a plumber's apprentice, going underneath houses and pulling out pipes. Everyone was so proud of him. He was making his own payments on a Chevy Camaro, and he had a white girlfriend. Talk about promising. I was the black sheep of the family, the only one to go to college. In high school, I had a GPA of 1.5. I was almost kicked out for getting in lots of trouble for bad things. I used to sell pot to my math teacher. My first semester in college, I suddenly find myself on the dean's list. I found out I was suited for college. I liked reading, especially literature. I became a writer. How do I survive on hundreds of dollars a year and still dress so nice and drink good wine? I teach. I'm a tenured professor at a university MFA in creative writing. I teach others how to write like me so they too can someday, if they are one of the few successful ones, make $300 a year off their writing. I teach graduate courses in literature and fiction. And in our field, our narrow little piece of language, that's been a success. Why do I do it? Why don't I write popular fiction, make lots of money, see my books made into films? Well, there's one thing I haven't told you about pop fiction. It's meant to be forgotten. When you read a pop novel, you're supposed to forget about it. That way you can go out and buy the new one just like it. Sometimes with the same characters, the same plot, the same bad guys blowing up the same White House. And when you're done reading, when you put the book down, you forget about that one too, and you go out and buy the next one. In literary fiction, the characters can stay with you forever. You think about them. Sometimes when you recall details of their lives, how much they loved the taste of water, you forget their fictional characters. Sometimes you even love them because the writer loves them. They are real people, real souls created by the power of love. Call me corny, but I think love is the better choice.
Well, that was another great show.
Yeah, I really enjoyed our conversation with Patrick Michael Finn, author of From Darkness, Right Underneath Our Feet, and a fellow Hudson Prize winner. Thank you, Patrick.
And thank you, Daniel, for your really, really wonderful reflection on the difference between pop lit and lit fic.
No, Ben, thank you for reading that wonderful poem. I look forward to getting her on the show, and I really enjoy hanging out with you.
We love hanging out here in Studio B.
With our incredible producer, Norma Martinez, who is behind the glass right now. Thank you, Norma, so much. And this show would not be possible without Norma.
And thank all of you for listening to another edition of Words on a Wire. So join us next week.
Don't forget,
the next book you read may
save
your
life.
I'm up on the tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on the tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see. And the wire seems to be the only place for me. A comedy of errors and a falling. Like a rubber-necked giraffe, you look into my past. Well, maybe you're just too blind to see. I'm up in the spotlight. Oh, does it feel right? Well, the altitude seems to get to me. I'm up on a tight wire, flanked by life and the funeral pyre. Putting on a show for you to see. Well, maybe you're just too blind to see.